It looks like there are people who are going to find a nice present under their Christmas trees this year, and some who are just getting coal in their stockings. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Yeah, it's good to be back with you, Barry. If you missed us last week, well, we were on, but you heard our much talked about and ballyhooed but never played Thanksgiving show. We had some technical difficulties last week, and we had one in the can, so we used it, and it was appropriate. It was
Chuck. I'm wondering with that though, could we claim that we suffer from holiday dysphoria and possibly get like a day named after us? Maybe somebody doing a fundraising campaign for us. And I'll be qualified for federal grants.
If we make it a genetic disorder and say it's something that we're born with and there's nothing that can be done about it, we might be able to get away with that. In fact, we might be able to form a foundation to raise money to find the cure.
Yeah, we'll call it Holiday Dysphoria Complex.
Yeah, there you go.
HDC.
Yep.
We suffer from HDC.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And it is an irrational fear of finding coal in your stocking. As that seems to be a theme in some of our shows lately. We've joked about that. I told the story about my daughters Liz and Rachel and Liz's famous drawing of Santa with smoke coming off his head saying, "No presents for Rachel, coal instead." So I have related that as a joke. We did wrap up some sticks and coal for our kids for Christmas one year, but they actually got Christmas too. So, but we gave them the sticks and coal just so they could go, "Oh, come on, Dad."
Well, you know, Chuck, here just recently I was actually listed and actually scored some votes in an online poll about that Third Rail Politics ran. Our friends over at Third Rail ran. About who would make the best Capitol Square Santa. Now, I got beat out by a pastor by the name of Tom Wise, who's from over in the Dayton area, who does a lot of prayer groups and things at the State House, because Tom's got this big, full, white, long beard.
Uh-huh,
okay?
Yeah.
It wasn't even close, and I didn't even want it to be close. I kind of laughed when I saw my name involved in it. But I did get some votes for that. But then I guess when people figured out that I was gleefully putting coal in the stockings of many of the State House regulars, they decided that they didn't want to give it to me.
Well, okay, you get 20 more years under your belt, and that beard gets a little white on its own, and you'll do nicely. You've got an infective laugh. That'll, you know, you just kind of convert it into a ho-ho-ho, and you're ready to go.
Yeah, well, there's that. Oh, but again, when it comes to politics, I'm the guy who likes to try to put coal in people's stockings. So that's just the way it goes.
Well, I know you've got as we are handing out coal for stockings on this program this year, and probably about every year, we do hand out some coal. We also give little presents to those that we think are doing a good job. So who do you think gets coal, and who do you think gets a good present this year?
Well, okay, I'm going to start with good presents, and the first good present that everybody's going to get is the American taxpayer, Chuck. As we know, as we're recording this is the Wednesday before Christmas. Here in about 2 hours, the president is going to be holding a press conference to announce the final passage and his signature upon the first major tax reform legislation in 31 years. Okay? They finally got it done. And you and I had a chat about this. We met earlier.
Well,
we were meeting, I think, late last week. And, when we first got together, you were talking about how you weren't sure how this, you know.
Okay.
It wasn't going to be great for you in the tax cuts. But
I did what the average American did. And that was I read the newspaper stories and I listened to the news. And I got told that I was going to, you know, here's the lump of coal in your stocking. And it was cuts in the property tax, cuts in the state income tax deduction, cuts in local income tax deductions, and blah, 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 blah. Well, it turned out, first of all, I don't pay local income tax out here. I do pay a state income tax out here for school.
That's the nice thing about living out in a township is you don't have to pay municipal income tax.
Right. We do pay a school income tax, and it's 1%, and I don't like it, but nonetheless. But I do pay state taxes. I pay plenty of state taxes. And, of course, I like deducting that. And I like deducting the home mortgage deduction. And it looked like I was going to be losing that as well. And then you and I started talking about it. And you did a little research, real quickie research in it. And we began breaking it down a little bit. And I said, oh, that looks pretty good. And, in fact, what it does is it shifts the burden of the tax burden away from states like Ohio that don't have an onerous state income tax. It's bad, but it's not horrible. Over to states that have terrible state tax and have terrible property tax issues like New Jersey, New York, California, Illinois, some of those places. And what you come to discover is, this is what I loved about it, red states who have generally lower tax structures no longer subsidize blue states with tax subsidies. In other words, if you're paying over $10,000 a year in property tax, you don't get that it's capped at 10K.
Right. And you know, God bless those who are paying over $10,000 per year in property taxes. You must have one incredible property at that point.
Yes, no kidding.
But the point is that even that is capped. So even if they were paying $25,000, Chuck, that means that they're only going to be paying on $15,000. You know, they lose the $15,000 they could have deducted. So that's tough for some people. But the point is, I don't know of anybody, or personally, that are paying even anywhere near the $10,000 mark. I know I don't, thank God.
Well, I can.
My property taxes, I think, are somewhat, you know, exorbitant, but they're not nearly that exorbitant. So for me, there's no change. I'm still going to be able to deduct it. Now, what may change is the fact that when I put all of my itemized deductions together from the kids stuff to my, you know, owning my own business to the property taxes to all that stuff, probably I was getting somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $7,000 or $8,000 in itemized deductions, maybe. And of course, the individual deduction level up till now at the federal level was a little over $6,000. So it made sense for me to itemize my deductions, right?
Yeah.
But with the tax reform that the president's signing this afternoon into law, my individual deduction, and of course we file jointly with my wife, so our joint deductible standard deduction is $24,000 that I can deduct right off the top. Chuck, if I can deduct that, and then I can still deduct... Yeah, you know, and I don't have to itemize. Well, first of all, that's going to save me on my tax preparation bill because I'm not going to have as many schedules.
It's so much easier. Let's face it. If you have a simpler income tax, it's really simple and easy to take the personal deduction.
Yes.
And every year, you know, if you're filling your taxes out with a tax program, a really good tax program will tell you what your personal deduction is, and it'll ask, do you expect to have more than blah, blah, blah in itemized deductions? And if the answer is no, they're like, don't bother going any further. Take the personal deduction.
Take the standard deduction and be happy. And in this case, if you're an individual, that standard deduction is $12,000.
Yeah.
And if you file jointly with a spouse, it's $24,000 of a standard deduction. Now, I know in many families you have, you know, have two incomes, and you know my wife is starting her own business, but of course she's been sinking a lot of money into it, not getting a lot of money out of it. So I'm looking at for my next probably, and of course this doesn't necessarily apply to this tax year; it'll apply to the next tax year. But I honestly see I'm going to probably A, get more money back, and B, pay less in tax preparation services because of the tax reform. And, you know, and if I decide that, you know, okay, maybe I'm between us, I can't imagine having more than $24,000 in itemized deductions. I'd really have to, like, be creative in figuring out how to create something as a deductible that way.
Well, let's face it. I mean, your income is not gigantic.
I lobby for pro-family nonprofits.
Yes, exactly.
That is not a way to quick wealth.
You're not a lobbying mogul.
I'm not the guys who are getting $20,000 a month from the universities to go in and get them more money from state taxpayers. No, that's not me.
That's not your thing. Your thing is to lobby for, and you do a great job of this, by the way, because I'm one of your customers.
Thank you.
that goes in. You are more of a, you're not an influence lobbyist. You're a confrontation lobbyist. In other words, you will go in and basically show them why they need to be looking at these issues from another perspective, providing large increases into campaign donation coffers and those kinds of things that a lot of other lobbyists may or may not engage in.
Many do.
Yes.
It's again, that's the whole, you know, we've talked about this before on the program. That's the difference between an access lobbyist. And when we use that term access, we mean the people who pay to get something from the legislators.
Pay to play.
They write campaign checks. They throw big, you know, lavish events and parties that the legislators are invited to. They take them on junkets or trips. You know, they give them gifts at the holidays. The kind of stuff that, honestly, Chuck, I mean, and maybe people may find that I'm too much of a Scrooge at this, I don't even send out Christmas cards. You know, way I look at it is, these people are there, they're doing a job that are getting paid for by the taxpayers who have received their jobs from the taxpayers in their districts going to the polls and giving them the job. And they get paid healthily. I mean, the average salary for a state legislator in Ohio is $61,000 a year. These legislators make more, and that's not counting their outside work.
I was going to say, that's part-time legislature.
You know, yeah. I just read an article this morning about the past couple of speakers and speaker wannabes, and the vast majority of them had outside businesses and incomes that were over $100,000 per year. And they had 2, 3, 4 of those going along with their legislative salaries. I mean, so, you know, these people are making plenty of money. But then, it costs money to run a campaign. Well, yes, it does. But you know what? If you're doing the right thing for the voters and you're passing legislation that the people need and that are is responsive to the doing the right thing, you won't have to spend that much money on a campaign. You can go out there and run on your record, which is the thing that they all talk about wanting to do, but that's the last thing that most of them actually want to ever have come up in a campaign is their actual record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, believe you me, you can ask some of them that I've run campaigns against. Again, more of that coal thing. But, of course, you know, we use the term confrontational lobbyist. You know, I'm not even a confrontational lobbyist. I'm more of a conscience lobbyist.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going in there to tell them, you know what the right thing to do is, and you ought to be doing it. And to make excuses of, well, you know, this will upset so-and-so, or so-and-so won't give us money in the caucus, is just showing that you're not principled and you're not working for the people who sent you here. You're working for the big money special interests who you hope to get a job from after you get out of the legislature.
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. They're thinking in terms of their future lobbying career.
Yeah. Yeah, to perpetuate the ongoing, you know, it's almost a really just disgusting little relationship. They get lobbied by these access folks so much that it starts becoming attractive to them, and then they want to become one.
Well, that...
You know, and it's really, you know, it's just sad. However, that's okay. You know, well, we'll leave that go where it is.
Somebody that we've talked about here from time to time, John Boehner, is just waiting for the 2 years to expire so he can go work at K Street.
Oh, he's already working at K Street.
Yeah, I was going to say.
They don't have a 2-year ban.
I thought they had a 2-year waiting period out of Congress.
No, that was at the state level, and it was a 1-year, and even it got waived after the courts decided that it was the revolving door policy, you know, wasn't constitutional. But they don't have a ban. They can go and you know, he went to work for K Street like 2 weeks after he left office. You know, you get hired on by a firm, and you may not directly, you know, you may not go in directly immediately, but you're certainly guiding and helping to quarterback every initiative and every strategy and every game plan that the lobbying firm has around the issues that you know and you have influence in, or you have personal relationships with the committee chairman that do have the influence over it. So, you know, you've got that whole situation going on. But thankfully, we've gotten past most of that with this. You know, this is something that Donald Trump campaigned on, you know, that we needed systemic reform of the tax system. And it was one of those things that we've kept hearing out of Republicans and Republican administrations and Republican leadership in the House and the Senate for years and years and years, always with this whole point of we can't get there because of name the excuse of the day. You know, it's like, let's go down the list, you know, go to Central Casting, go down the list. Okay, we'll use that excuse this year. and they never get it done. Like I said, we've not had any significant reform of the federal tax code in 31 years.
And it was a bad one. That was TEFRA in 1986. I remember that very well.
Yeah.
And guess what we lost then? Up until that point, we had consumer interest was deductible. In other words, when you had a 26% Discover bill interest rate, you could deduct everything you paid in interest on that credit card from your taxes.
Right.
Well, you got, you know, you don't get a straight deduction. You get 1/3 of that amount, I think, is the way it works. Nonetheless, a lot of people were deducting a lot of interest, and we lost all that. For some reason, the Democrats had decided that the 1981 tax cuts, or 81 or 82, were just too onerous. Now, what they really meant was, we've got to get some kind of victory. We saw the increase in revenue that tax cut brought, and we spent all the money. So we've got to get more money in here, and the only way to do it is, now that business is kind of back up and running, we got to tax them so we can get even more revenue out of it. Well, what did it do to the revenue? It flattened. It flattened after 1986. That was the big tax reform that the Democrats shoved through. And remember, they were in charge of the... I'm trying to remember if they were in charge of both houses in 86. It was a close, like it is now, in the Senate, with the loss of the seat in Alabama. It's now going to be 51-49. In any case, at the time, the Democrats pushed that through, and all of a sudden, business conditions went flat. And it's like, so how do tax increases work in the economy? That wasn't going to fix everything, because we were going to fix the deficit. Well, all the increased revenues from the 81 or 82, I can't remember, tax cuts, which doubled, by the way, federal revenues. That I can remember talking about that, and people said it didn't do any such thing, it blah blah blah. And I went and looked at the numbers, and I go, that early 80s tax cut doubled federal revenue.
Yes.
And that's exactly what, you know, people are still disparaging Reaganomics. If you go to a history book, you'll read about the horrible Reagan tax cuts. And I said, you mean the ones that pulled us out of the recession we'd been in since 1977? That horrible tax cut?
Yeah, that one.
Come on, folks. this is the problem with who you let write history. There are people who are willing to say anything. You know, that for years we were told that Joseph Stalin was just this saintly figure, who was an American ally and all that stuff. Was Joseph Stalin a saintly finger, Barry?
Only to his mama, maybe.
I'm not sure she really was real happy with him, because she wanted him to become an Orthodox priest. And he was quickly removed from the seminary he was attending. His mother somehow weaseled her way, and I think she worked for someone who had an inn and got Joseph into the seminary, and he started reading Marx while he was in the seminary, and his seminary career was essentially an excuse to, you know, he became a professional student, like we see so many times now. But that being said, it depends on who writes the history. And if you go and read an economic history book right now, people will talk about how awful Reaganomics were. And no,
yes,
it was pretty good time considering what we'd had from 1977 to 1981. Because it was rough. It was real rough, Barry. I worked in Indiana. I was a traveling salesman. That was a terrible time to be a salesman in Indiana. Let me tell you something. 1979 was about the peak of it, and that's when I started. I rolled into towns like Anderson, Indiana, and Muncie, Indiana, which were both big GM towns. 29% unemployment, 30% unemployment. I had a friend who was working sales in Michigan, Flint, 52% unemployment at one point. 52, that means every other person who had been working was unemployed. Now, that's depression territory. And it's same way in Anderson and Muncie. And Indianapolis wasn't in good shape either, because it was very reliant on car manufacture. And it was a terrible time. Interest rates. I tried to buy a house in 1981. I tried to buy a house in December of 1980. I tried to buy a house in I think it was in December of 1980. They laughed at me at the bank. They said, well, if you could get a mortgage, which you can't, it would be 22.75%.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, I was able to get a land contract at about 14 or 15%, but consumer interest rates were in the 30% range. It was just terrible. Everything was double digit. I got forced to buy a car because I was in a near fatal car accident in March of 1981. I got forced to buy a car in the spring of 1981, and the best I could do was 16% interest on a car loan.
And those were the days of some heavy, heavy taxation and interest.
And inflation was running about 12 or 13%.
Now, it's a little different these days. Now, first of all, though, if you take a look, I mean, not only is this this new tax reform piece that'll go into law here, and again, this is going to go in where many of these tax tables are going to get altered and changed by February. So many American workers are going to find the tax bite a lot less in their weekly take home. They're also going to be seeing that, you know, as we're seeing, because, you know, you and I, we do it at with withholdings and things and paying at the end of the year or
right.
In the quarterly
we'll probably, or whatever.
We'll probably be seeing some of that impact as well.
Mine's a little
now,
different.
If you couple
yeah.
that, if you couple what just happened at the federal level with what we've experienced for the last couple, three cycles in the state, and again, I will give credit where credit's due. I know we beat up on him a lot, but one of the things that Governor Kasich has been willing to do is work with the legislature to reform and change some of the taxing structures in Ohio to where much of the taxation regarding small businesses has become much less problematic and much less onerous. You know, and again, if you're even remotely smart, which obviously most of these progressive liberals slept through these classes in college, or perhaps they were out protesting at the dean's office, yeah. You understand that in order to have a vibrant economy, the engine of that economy has to be the small local businesses. You can't run a good economy, whether at the local, county, state, or federal level, just upon the multinational corporations. It doesn't work. You have to have the small mom-and-pop operations manufacturing a good or coming up with a service or inventing a process or an idea that helps to, you know, move us forward and strengthen the economy. I mean, if you think about it, most people, Chuck, never ponder this kind of thing. And I know you do sometimes, and I do as well. When I look at a product, something even simple, let's say like a cup of coffee. I'm sitting here with a gas station cup of coffee. But I have to stop here and think, I just paid 69 cents for this big 20-ounce cup of coffee. Yeah, I drank too much coffee. and they were running a sale, too. So I only paid 69 cents for this cup of coffee. But with this cup of coffee, there's all kinds of small businesses that were involved in getting this into my hand.
Oh, absolutely.
And for me to only pay 69 cents to get it. You know, because you have to have somebody who grows the coffee, who has the land, who decides to grow the coffee beans, who hires people to harvest, you know, and then they have to also pay for the whatever chemicals or, you know, insecticides, pesticides, et cetera, they have to use in order to keep the bugs from eating it up. They have to pay somebody to harvest it. They have to go through the processes of maturing it, drying it. That all takes equipment. That takes.
Well, yeah.
If you start looking. You know, we have a miracle in front of us called capitalism. Because you can't do that in a command economy, in a only multinational corporations may apply and the government runs everything. This 69-cent cup of coffee, first of all, I might not even have enough money to be able to buy 69 cents, but I'll guarantee you this cup of coffee would cost more than Starbucks.
Yeah.
If it was all a command economy.
Exactly.
But if you think about it, because not only are we talking about the coffee, we're talking about the water to brew it. Where did that come from? How did they get there? Did they just somebody go down to the creek with a bucket and dip it out? Well, okay, first of all, then where'd they get the bucket? You know, you start thinking about these things. Multinational corporations and government doesn't manufacture all of these things. It's the small, oftentimes family businesses, the mom and pop stores, the little garage band kind of, industrious entrepreneurial mindsets out there that make the things that help us to have the comforts that we have in this country. And so the last thing we need to be doing is making it harder for them to start those businesses, harder for them to pay people and employ people in those businesses, and harder for them to do the bookkeeping and to keep those businesses' doors open because of regulation and overburdensome taxes.
That's exactly why, but burdensome regulation that hurts the small businessman most and benefits large businesses, which is often the way it's set up. And there are reasons for that. It's essentially, it's the large businesses doing their best to get the small guy out of the way. It's the reason why when Walmart comes to town in a small town, they what you'll see is a lot of those rollback prices.
Right.
Okay. They'll come in and roll back. In other words, they'll do loss leader to run the little guy down the street out of the business. And then once the little hardware store down the street's out of the business, what happens to those prices? Those rollbacks again. No, those rollback prices roll forward, baby. Because it's all about knocking the competition out of the way. That's
well,
the problem.
You know, and we had this here in our little hometown too. We had a nice little hardware store that sat right off the park. And you've been here in Gallup.
Yeah.
You know, like right in the middle of town, there's this big park. It's like an entire city block. It's a park. Well, right off the park, across the street from it, was this mom-and-pop hardware store that had been there since the 1800s.
Yeah.
They survived Walmart coming in, but then when Walmart and Rural King both came in, they found they couldn't compete. And so last summer, they closed their doors.
Yep.
You know, and I get it because, you know, sometimes, you know, you have things where you can improve processes or things. And yes, there is a benefit to, you know, quantity purchases and getting volume discounts and things of that nature and passing those along to consumers. But ultimately, you got to have some place where if somebody walks in there and says, you know, I got this thing going on and I need this piece, but I'm not sure what you got. You need to have somebody who maybe has enough, you know, background and knowledge or has had the experience with these same type of issues before to say, I know exactly what you need. Come on over here.
Okay. Let me give you, for instance, we have a little hardware in downtown Newark. It's called, sure. It used to be called Main Hardware. Now it's called Orm, a company called Orm Bottom Out, and runs a lot of these little True Value hardware stores.
Sure.
And you've got to have a place where you can go and have an oddball piece of glass cut. Or you can go in and find a stainless steel screw that only that you need four of them, and you don't need
you don't need 50 of them in a package.
Yeah, you don't want a 1,000 pack, even if you can find it. No, good luck finding that kind of stuff at Home Depot and that kind of thing. No, I went in there and I have these ancient aluminum frame windows that have springs on the inside. Well, what happens when you've got a 40-year-old spring? They break.
They do break.
Spring steels rust out and break. So what did I do? Well, I went down to Orm Hardware, and I said, okay, what can you do for me on one of these? And we tested the pull, and we estimated, you know, how many pounds of pull it was. And he goes, you know, I don't have anything exactly like that. But he goes, if you look over here, I've got something that's twice as long. And he said, you could get a tin snipper and sniff this in half and, you know, refashion the hook on the end. And I can do that. And he's like, yeah, have you got a vise? Yeah, I do actually. So he led me, he says, try that. So I went home and did it, and by golly, it worked. Now it took me about an hour to get the stuff shaped the way it needed to be and restring all the string and all that stuff. But by golly, it worked. Now, could I have done that at Rural King? No. Could I have done that at Home Depot or Lowe's or even Menards? No, I couldn't have. Why? Because I'd have found somebody who basically knew how to stock the shelves in his area. So he knew what was available in his area. But did he have an innovative idea for me to be able to get that done? The answer is no. Could I have had an oddball piece of glass or plexiglass cut? Well, I could have, but I'd have to order it and wait 8 days for it to come in.
Sure.
If I do go down to Orm, I say, hey, how quick can you cut me this weirdo hunk of glass? And they go, oh, go have lunch, and by the time you come back, we'll have a cut for you. Sometimes they'll say, bring the fixture in, and we'll put it in for you for blah, blah, blah dollars, which is well worth it. And that's the problem. These big guys come in and abuse their abilities to run everybody else out. And then when it comes time, this is why, Barry, the economy is changing over from big box stores like Home Depot and Lowe's and Rural King and those kinds of things over to Amazon. Because even though you can't walk in an Amazon store and buy it, usually you can have it in a day or two. Well, the last time I tried to order something from one of the big box stores, they're like, it'll be here 2.5 weeks. 2.5 weeks.
Right.
I can buy it 30% less and get it in 2 days from Amazon. Why would I come to you? So we're seeing those guys' own models throttling them. And now, where did we start out? We started out at government regulation, making it hard for the little guy to compete. And the fact is, that's still the case. Taxation, that kind of thing. The little guy, like Orm Hardware, has to have a big building so they can store all the stuff and have all the tools that they need to use that they will, by the way, rent you, something that's also a problem in some of the big box stores. Now, where are they in trouble? Well, taxation. Taxation can kill a business because in order to make that work, you got to have a lot of employees who know what they're doing. And if they know what they're doing, you got to pay them more money, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't hire a high school kid and have him come in and know how to rebuild a sump pump, right?
Yeah.
He may know. Chances are he doesn't know. How does he find out? Well, he works under a guy at the hardware store who shows him how to do it.
No. He just goes to YouTube, Chuck.
Right. Well, I do that. Yeah, that's the way I do it. But that being said, what do you have to do? Well, under the Obamacare, you know, under the laughably misnamed Affordable Care Act, you were required, if a person worked a certain number of hours, to make that benefit available to them. You got to pay unemployment. You got to pay insurance. You got to offer some kind of health plan if you want to keep the employees. There's all these things. Employees are expensive. People say, well, I'm only making $30,000 a year. Okay. What does it cost that businessman to pay you $30,000 a year? Probably over $60,000 a year to pay you $30,000.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? Well, he has to make enough money to pay himself and you. And if he pays himself $50,000 a year, it's going to cost him probably about $75,000 to $100,000 a year to pay himself $50,000 a year.
Right.
These are just facts. Because Social Security, Medicaid, and the corporation has to match it. This is part of the reason why I'm an employee of a corporation, which I'm the stockholder. Why do I do that? So the company will pay my Social Security and my Medicaid and all these, this, that, and other thing, and all my benefits and stuff, rather than me have to pay it out of pocket. Why is that important? Because it's deductible to the corporation. This is why tax policy is so important to a small business. Because of the deductibility and spreading the cost through the advantage of the corporation. This is why when you see Antifa's and some of the railing against corporations, they don't know what they're talking about. A corporation is essentially a way for you to have a separate person who pays, who handles some of the expenses that if we were all individual business owners, we couldn't do. You have to build in those advantages, or the backbone of your economy, which is the small businessman, the people we just talked about, the Orm Hardwares, the local drugstore. Yeah, okay. How many local drugstores have you seen recently? How many are left?
I don't know if there are any, Chuck.
There are.
I guess they did just open one up here in our town. It's a little small, but I think it's affiliated with the hospital. So I don't even consider that a local small town drugstore.
It's a handful. My father, when I was young, my dad bought a drugstore in Hebron, Ohio, in 1960, 59 or 60, I believe. And what has become of that drugstore? Well, my dad stole it. My dad saw the handwriting on the wall as early as 42 years ago. He said the day of the local family-owned drugstore is coming to an end. It's all going to corporate. And at the time, the big players were companies like Gray Drug and Drug Emporium and those kinds of places. Where are they? Well, they're all absorbed into CVS, Walgreens, some of those guys, which are now gigantic players. So we're in that cycle in that certain things have forced out other things. If you walk into a CVS pharmacy, how much business of their business model is actually prescriptions? Do you suppose? An estimate.
Probably maybe 15-20%.
If that. What are they selling? Yeah. Greeting cards, pop,
right.
Reading glasses, magazines, candy.
Knickknacks.
Yeah.
Makeup.
Band-aids, yeah. Shaving supplies, aisles and aisles and aisles of stuff other than pharmaceuticals. And to some extent, it was that way when my dad owned a drugstore. I mean, my dad had a huge tobacco counter. One of my fondest memories is walking in my dad's drugstore when he still had a tobacco counter. That smell will never leave me. I'll die still being able to smell that tobacco counter because it smelled marvelous. I'm allergic to cigarette smoke, and I do not like that smell. But let me tell you, that pipe tobacco and those cigars in that cabinet.
You ever walk into a walk-in humidoir in a cigar shop? That's the
same smell. It's just and there's another smell that I remember. My dad sold roasted nuts.
Oh, I was just about to bring that up.
A nut roaster. He had a nut roaster.
That has to be my favorite, you know, scent memory from childhood. The old G.C. Murphy stores. I don't know if you remember those.
I do. Yeah.
Five and dime type thing. The local one here in town, my mom would take me in, and there'd be three things I'd go in for. One was G.I. Joe figures to see if I could have enough money to buy the latest one. Number two was they had this great rack of paperback books. And number three was right in the middle of the store, there was a nut roaster where they roasted whole cashews.
Cashews, yeah. I remember the cashews, almonds, and peanuts they had in there. And you could get Brazil nuts and that kind of stuff, too. They had a mixed nut. But I remember that smell. And
for our local folks, right downtown at the corner of State and High Street, there is a Planters peanut shop.
Oh,
where
no
they
kidding.
Roast the nuts in the shop.
No kidding. We'll have to go there when I'm in town one of these days.
When we have to go to the State House or something, I will take you over there and we'll get some nuts because it is marvelous to walk into that place.
Yeah.
Now, there's another one down south on High Street, just about two or three blocks from the State House. That has done the same thing for decades. And I mean, you walk into the one up on State and High, it's good, it's nice, it smells wonderful. You walk at the one down there about three blocks down below, that's the one. You know, that's the smell that brings me all the way back to being a kid.
Yep. And see, the problem is that you got to sell a lot of nuts to pay the rent on a downtown store.
And nuts are not cheap to procure either.
No, they're not.
Especially cashews, Brazil nuts, some of those more exotic ones. Those are a little harder to come by.
Yeah. Now, you know, how do those kind of costs affect a small business? Well, like I said, my dad sold all that stuff. He also sold Timex watches. When I was a kid, they'd throw out the old Timex display. We'd grab it. And we'd put Matchbox cars on it and all kinds of stuff. You know, they'd put it out in the trash. I remember hauling trash out. Dad, can I have this Timex display? Yes, please get it out of here.
Oh, my.
And I'd take it home, and we put our Matchbox cars on it and all kinds of stuff.
Now, don't you wish you still had some of those?
Oh, boy, don't I. You know what those would be worth?
Yeah, they're not cheap. That's cheap.
That is a small business. Now, my dad had, were those Timex displays free? No, he got charged rent on those, or they charged him a lease, and at the end of the lease, you know, he owned it, and so what? Then they sent him another one. But those are the kinds of expenses that small businesses have to deal with that aren't the same as large businesses, which is another one of the presents that was in this tax bill, and that is the cut in tax rate to pass through corporations. In other words, my corporation is what's called an S-Corp. S stands for shareholder. I am the shareholder in this corporation. Well, what happens if I show a profit? Supposedly, if that profit passes directly to me, and everybody who would see my tax forms would say, your corporation made a huge amount of money. And I always laugh. I call my accountant. He says, you made $30,000 this year. I go, well, shouldn't I have $30,000 to show for
exactly.
it if I made $30,000? And he says, oh, you reduced the negative equity in your corporation. And I said, oh, you mean I paid people I owed money to for longer than I should have? And he said, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but then that's counted as income to you because you're able to pay off debt.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's paid at a higher rate.
In one sense, because that's the only way anybody can pay off debt is if they actually make money to pay it off with. But to count it against you twice is a problem.
And it was paid at a higher rate.
Of course.
Because that was a pass-through profit. That was paid at a higher rate. So, in other words, I made money I never saw, and I had to pay a higher rate than you would. Or, you know, than anybody who's just simply one of my employees would have to pay on their salary. So, again, why is that advantageous to a business? Well, if I decide I need a little help around here, I need to hire a part-timer. Any $10 I can free up is $10 I can pay somebody. Now, I've hired contractors around here and stuff.
Yeah, and let's put a plug in for one of your contractors.
Oh, yeah, Bruce Purdy from Purdy Handyman Services in Lancaster, who does a great job, by the way. Bruce, you owe me money.
and I'm a witness, so I'll talk to him about your payment plan.
No, but he has been very helpful to me here, and he has helped me get some things done in this building because I converted a barn into an office and a warehouse. So it was a long slog, and he was very helpful. Another small businessman. Now, see, there's another example of the small businessman. I didn't go to some big giant remodeling guy to do this, remodeling contractor. I went to a local businessman. Why? Well, I know Bruce and I trust him and I've seen his work.
And I'll vouch for that. He does a fantastic job. Yep. I've worked with Bruce before, not in that capacity, but he used to work with me at CCV. His calling is definitely in doing handyman job and woodworking. He's fantastic at it.
Yeah, he's got a shop in his basement, and he can, if you got something you need to have done, he can cook you something up. If he can't find something to do, he can cook you something up, fabricate a part and that kind of stuff. So that's why you go to a small contractor, because you can't get that kind of stuff from the big guys.
You can, but it's going to cost twice as much and take three times as long.
Through the nose, baby. You're going to really pay. You're going to really pay. Because, you know, it's a different kind of setup. That's why the small businessman is the backbone of the economy. You see the big contractors and the big players and the rural kings and Tractor Supply Company and that kind of thing. What don't you see? Well, you don't see yourself on a Saturday going down to have a key cut down at the local hardware store or to go.
I've actually done that a couple of times, and I hate to say it, at Walmart, but normally you have to wait around forever, and then they always have to ask two or three different people, and sometimes they can't get it to fit right. And I used to get keys cut at the local hardware store all the time. You just go in there, and, you know, they had all the different blanks. You went in, bam, 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 and you had it done. You were out the door.
Exactly. And that is the beauty of it. Do you pay a little more? Yes. Is it worth it? Well, that's up to you.
Aesthetically, absolutely. In a longer-term sense of having a strong economy, yes, it's very much worth it. I always subscribe. There's an economist that I know you and I have both read by the name of Gary North. And Gary North talks about convenience and the monetary value of your time.
That's right.
And for me, in this respect, I would more likely want to have the small businessman, the small mom and pop hardware store. I'd rather go in and get my key cut for them because I get that personal service. It doesn't take, you know, it takes just about the same amount of time to cut a key in one machine as it does the other. But I don't have to walk through a football field size store to some obscure corner and then try to chase down an employee to try to get a key cut versus walking in, and usually it's the owner or somebody in the owner's family who's working the counter who will probably drop what they're doing and come right over and cut your key for you.
Well, Roush Hardware in Westerville. Now, that's a little different situation in that it's employee owned. So you go, if you want a key cut, you go back to the key counter. That's where you go. And there's a guy standing there and he'll say, "Can I cut that for you?" "Yeah, sure." And he'll tell you, he'll look at it and go, "You know what? I can't cut this kind of key because it's got a chip in it."
Right.
But he'd go over here and pick, you want a regular old key. He's like, "Here, take one of these keys," and he'll pull one off and they'll even program it for you. It costs a little extra because the darn key chips are expensive. But he says, for that cost, we program it.
Well, and that's nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, you try to get that done at Home Depot, good luck.
I'm not seeing that happening.
Yeah, it can be done, but you got to find the guy who knows how to do it. And he's at lunch right now. Can you come back in 40 minutes? Yeah, you don't get that. No, I've never walked into a local mom and pop hardware store and not had somebody immediately say, "What are you looking for?" And you give them a description, they'll go, "Come over here to aisle 5. Is this what you're looking for?" "Yes, that's exactly what I'm looking for."
Or they'll say, "Well, yeah, we don't have something like that, but I bet we can make something out of this, this, and this."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Is that a biblical kind of economy? That's the real question here. Since we're a biblical kind of show, which is more like the kind of business that we're asked to create in the Bible? Is it a giant corporation that, it tries to be all things to all people, or is it a little local mom and pop who does their best to help you get the things done you need to have done? Well,
I would say it's a yes and, it's not an either or, it's a yes and, because I think we need to create those mom and pop businesses and get them strong and hire people and be able to maybe spin them off and create more businesses out of them, or associated businesses, or what they call vertical integration, where you find you need something, you know, to help manufacture X, and so instead of going out on the market and buying it somewhere else, you start manufacturing it with a subsidiary division, and then you grow your company into a bigger company. There's nothing wrong with growth and profit at all. It's just the question of, is your focus on just the money aspect of
it,
or the aspect of doing all your work unto the Lord? And, you know, if you, as I think the quote is attributed to Martin Luther, you know, if you make shoes, then make shoes unto the Lord.
That's the old story about the cobbler who asked him how he could serve the Lord best, and he said, "Make better shoes."
Make better shoes. That's right.
Yeah. Now that's probably an apocryphal story, but it fits. It fits in the kind of advice that Martin Luther would have given on that situation. We started this discussion talking about Sherrod Brown and his attempt to gain re-election favor with tax policy. That's exactly what's wrong with tax policy. What are you trying to do? You're trying to pick winners and losers with who you give better and worse rates to. And if you're a politician, you're trying to pay off your friends and make it possible for your friends to do better while your friends' competitors do worse. This is why,
and that's never a good thing.
Yeah, that's never, ever, ever a good thing. This is why it's the tax policy against the small and medium-sized businessman with these pass-through entities has been terrible for years. Because what happened? We're punished for actually becoming successful.
That's true.
And we subsidize corporations who very often get better rates than we do.
Yeah, that's also a big problem if you think about it.
Yeah. And when you read tax codes, when you read some of these tax laws and specific things in specific districts are written in for specific breaks, Jim Wright was infamous for that when he was Speaker of the House of Representatives. He got people, not just him, some chairman of the House Ways and Means and Committees and Tax Committees did the same thing, would write special exemptions and tax breaks in for their constituents in their districts that nobody else could get. Well, what is that? That's corruption.
It's a form of nepotism, and it's supposedly illegal. Because steering federal law in order to benefit a donor or someone who you have a fiduciary interest or some kind of interest in their business is supposed to be illegal.
Yeah, but it goes on all the time. Hey, I know you want to give some coal out, and we only got about 6 or 7 minutes left. So
yeah, I guess, you know, in holding to my idea that I am the Grinch that stole Christmas, I got to give at least one lump of coal. People are going to think it's a little weird. But I'm giving this lump of coal because somebody sent me a Christmas card. Yes, that's right. I'm a horrible, horrible human being, and so I'm going to be blasting somebody who sent me a Christmas card.
But the person I'm blasting is because this Christmas card, which was sent and supposedly was coming from them and their personal, you know, from them personally, and it was just so thoughtful of them to send me a Christmas card, was actually basically nothing more than a paid political advertisement for a politician. And that really, honestly, Chuck, offended me to no end. The card that I'm talking about was a Christmas card, and it was coming. And when I got the, you know, it had the card size envelope and everything. So I'm like, okay. And I flip it around to the back before opening it. And on the back flap, it says it's from the Husted family. Yes, that's right. John Husted, who's now the running mate for Mike DeWine's gubernatorial race, because they cut a deal and decided that, instead of fighting against each other and spending money against each other in a primary, they would just basically try to, run the zone against Jim Renacci and against Mary Taylor, who are both running for the same job of governor. And they could just basically team up and use their money to flush the other ones out of the race. Still hasn't worked for them yet. But so Husted sends this thing, and it says from the Husted family, and it has his address, 211 South 5th Street in Columbus. And I thought, oh, isn't that lovely? 211 South 5th Street. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. I know what 211 South 5th Street is. It's the Ohio Republican Party headquarters. It's not John Husted's home. It's not his. So you get this lovely card, you know, and it's like got a scripture verse inside, or a partial scripture verse. And it's got this picture of John and his second wife, and his son and the two daughters I think he's had with his second wife. But the picture, it's probably taken in spring or summer. There's green foliage in the background. They're all wearing short sleeve shirts. It's sunny. You couldn't even get in the studio and take a picture like with the Christmas, you know, style attire or something that looked like it was actually winter. No, they just found a picture somewhere and gave it to the party and said, here, just use this. And the party put this mailing together. And, of course, at the very back of the card, at the very bottom of the card, it says, paid for by the Ohio Republican Party. So here's a guy, and this is like an epitome of what I have problems with John Husted. He puts himself forward as one thing, but when you start digging and you start looking at the particulars, you realize it's something else entirely. What this is, the facing and the fronting of this is, I'm thoughtful and I'm sending you a Christmas card because, you know, you're a friend of mine and I'm celebrating the season. What it really is I'm so shallow that I just basically had the party throw something together for me, mail it to a mailing list. I gave him a picture from last summer sometime or whenever this was taken. And I hope you're gullible enough to think that this was a personal touch. So my big lump of coal for Christmas is going to John Husted.
Well, I think that's an appropriate lump of coal. So we've given basically a present to Congress and the president for passing what looks like a pretty decent tax cut for that should stimulate the economy, and we've given a lump of coal to John Husted for doing what politicians do best, and that is try to run a scam.
Indeed.
Yeah. Now, that being said, since Monday is Christmas Day, and Sunday is Christmas Eve, hey, we want to encourage you to remember the reason for the season. The reason for the season is the celebration of the birth of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. May you remember that as you attend a Christmas Eve service on Sunday, whether you go in the morning or go in the evening or go both. And I encourage you to go both. I always love Christmas Eve services, especially when Christmas Eve is a Sunday. Be sure to be in church to worship the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, who came to give his life for our sins. And this is kind of the way we feel about this. We want you to remember the reason for the season. And even if they don't say Merry Christmas to you at whatever store you go ahead and say it to them.
Try and say it back.
Hey, yeah. If they say Happy Holidays, say Merry Christmas. That being said, You know what we think. We very much want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.